Welcome back to Portrait of an Editor. I am Francis Lombard. First, a huge congratulations to Alex Segura for winning the Los Angeles Times Book Prize for the Mystery Thriller category for his novel Secret Identity. As for this interview, which was recorded prior to his win, it's a companion piece with my interview with Cliff Chang, in which I get to talk with a former editor and see how their days as an editor influences their creative process today. Also, of course, we talk about Secret Identity, and Alex provides hints at what his next novel will be about. A bonus, for free, you can listen to my first conversation with Alex over at the Portrait of an Editor Patreon page. That interview took place in 2019. Also, for a buck a month, you can get all the interviews that are there, which go all the way back to 2017. Now, here's my conversation with Alex. Enjoy. Alex, welcome back to Portrait of an Editor. Like we were just talking about, the last time you talked was probably, I'm thinking almost 3 years ago. It'd be nice if I looked it up before I start getting on these things. But
yeah, it might even be longer than that.
I think it might. I know you were at Archie, and we spent a lot of time talking about Dark Circle and the work that you had done, the editing that you had done on that. So maybe even longer. I know it was pre-COVID, so it's probably 4 years. And I've been, and now it reminds me how long I've been doing this podcast, and following your career. Which congratulations on 2022.
Thanks.
It looks like you had a good year. So
yeah, I mean, Secret Identity has done really well. It seems like I'm able to keep busy, so a lot to be thankful for, and I'm just appreciative that people are reading.
Well, and Secret Identity was, you know, not the only thing you did. You had the Black Ghost came back, which, I mean, Greg Lockhart and I've talked about before, and then you're writing into the Avengers right now for Marvel. What is it, online, and then will that be in print too eventually at one point? I mean,
I'm not sure what their mechanism is for the, I did an arc of Avengers Unlimited for Marvel, and it's on, you can get it through the Marvel Unlimited app or website. And and the Black Ghost, the second season of Black Ghost came out last month, which is exciting. It came out in print through Dark Horse. It was originally serialized by Comixology Originals. And we just announced over the weekend at WonderCon that we're going to be doing a print version of the Legendary Lynx comics through Image. So that's exciting. And that's, if you read Secret Identity, you know, it's a story of a woman who comes to New York to pursue her career in comics in the 70s and creates this, I'm just giving you like the very abridged version, but creates this character called the Legendary Lynx. And she does it anonymously. And so the arc of the mystery is her basically reclaiming this IP. But, you get to see pages of the comic in the novel by Sandy Jarrell. And so what we're doing is expanding on those pages. So you really get to experience the full comic in that world. So we're doing it as a really meta kind of twist, which has been fun.
Now, that comic, I think in the book, it runs like, it only ran like 7 issues or 6 issues, right? Was it? I can't remember.
Yeah, I mean, I don't want to spoil too much, but there are 7 or 8 issues that are relevant to the novel, but then there's an aside that says, oh, it continued for a little while after. I'm actually working on the sequel or a story set in the same world in the modern day. So you get a little more historical context, but yeah, the idea is that this print version will be the first 4 issues kind of reprinted and remastered.
Now, was that a plan or that of... because I know Tom King's book, he had comic pages and stuff like that, but I don't think the characters...
Oh, I didn't know that.
Yeah, there was... I have it, and I got to get to it. I think I read a bit of it when I had COVID a little while ago, just isolating. And I got to get back to it. But there's comic pages in that. I know that's the book, I think, that broke him. And people, you know, that I think he's been writing comics ever since. But he hasn't seemed to gone back to that world... for whatever reason. My question, and this goes back to you've been an editor, you came into comics as marketing, was, right, seeing we're talking about Secret Identity and you're expanding that world, was this something about doing a comic with the character that your lead in Secret Identity creates. Was this something that was a plan from the get-go, or was it something that your eyes opened up to somewhere along the process?
I think it was always in the back of my mind. I mean, the genesis of Secret Identity, mystery-wise, was that I wanted to tell a mystery, a murder mystery set in the world of comics. Mm-hmm. I wanted it to be a world of comics that wasn't necessarily familiar to fans today, like an era where we didn't have the multimedia exposure, we barely had the direct market, you know, just a whole different kind of world. The comic book aspect came to me years and years ago when I was reading Cavalier and Clay, which I loved and still love. And I remember just wanting to read those Escapist comics, which Dark Horse did eventually do as a separate product. So, yeah. But they weren't embedded in the novel. And so as a reader, I was like, huh, it would have been cool to hop from the prose to the comic. And that was just like something buzzing around my brain. And then, you know, fast forward 20 years later, and I'm working on Secret Identity, the novel. And this was before it even got sold to Flatiron. And I thought, wouldn't it be cool if, you know, you're following Carmen's adventure, but then you get to actually read parts of the comic. And as Sandy and I, Sandy Gerald, who's an amazing artist and just has a great knack for comic book history. And really what I love what he did is he didn't imitate. He wasn't trying to do like, oh, let's do Frank Miller here, or let's do Gene Colan here, or let's do whatever, or Sal Buscema. He was definitely evoking the era. And so as we were doing this, we kept saying to each other, like, there's more here. You know, if we get the runway later, because we did all the prep work, you know, we worked on the character, we came up with the world, the visuals. And so it felt like not a waste, but unfulfilled potential to, you know, just put it out there in those excerpts and not finish the story. So I guess what the image book is going to be, which we're doing with Chris Ryle's Syzygy imprint, it's going to be the full issue. So you get a lot more of the context of who the character is and how it fits into that era. And so I don't want to say it was always part of the plan, but the germ of the idea was always kind of there.
Do you feel that maybe your marketing experience or just overseeing as an editor allowed you to look at this world that you're creating and the potential of like being able to spread it across a number of different mediums?
I think so. I mean, I think it's from an editorial perspective, one of the things that I gleaned from my time as an editor at Archie was project management. And that's like a key element of being an editor. It's, you know, getting the right team together. And it's something I end up doing anyway on my creator-owned stuff. Like even something like Black Ghost, where Greg Lockhart is the editor, or Blood Oath, where Heather Antos is the editor, a lot of the kind of outreach and, you know, getting the team together falls to me just because experientially I have that experience and kind of can do that. And, you know, Heather and Greg were amazing in terms of once the book was getting done and giving notes and giving feedback and managing the pages. But a lot of that kind of front end stuff before even editorial was on the book kind of falls to me just because I have that experience and have an idea of what I want the book to be. So in terms of the links, I don't think it was more a marketing thing more than an editorial like or story. Hey, this would be cool. Like as a reader, I would think that would be cool. Like I love meta stories. I love stories that weave through history. So this idea that this is a comic from 1975, wink, wink, and we're remastering it and repackaging it and it fits into this world. Like I kind of love the idea that we manifested this character into comic book history. And it's not a trick. We're not trying to trick anyone. Mm-hmm. But if you look at it closely, you're like, huh, this could have fit in there. And it doesn't really disrupt anything that precedes it. It almost exists. We almost willed it into existence, which is thrilling to me. And I think people really enjoy the art and the story. And it's got a retro vibe, but it's also very modern, I think.
I have to, for a side, I just wrapped up finishing the book about, completely, Warren Publishing, which you actually mentioned in the back of Secret mm-hmm. Identity, and then jumped right into Secret Identity. And I'm like, okay, I know this world, especially from what was going on over at Warren Publishing, and that great was, what is it, the Empire of Monsters.
Yes, that's a great book. And it's definitely a huge inspiration in terms of, like, the idea of, I really wanted Triumph Comics, which is Carmen's company, the company she works for as mm-hmm. as the editor-in-chief's like secretary or assistant. I wanted to give that vibe of a Charlton or a Warren or a Quality, like definitely not in the big leagues of Marvel and DC, but still in the mix, you know, still in the running there.
I also ended up just reading like the John Byrne, Roger Stern short run on Captain America, which is 1980, which, you know, mm-hmm. maybe 5 years after the world that you're where you're planting your flag, and just how different comics were back then. Basically, I mean, just the amount of text that are in it, sort of the approach to artwork, just the idea of, and you talk about it a great deal in Secret Identity too, about cranking out the books, making sure they're on time, and especially some of the stuff I was reading of just like how they needed to make their deadlines, and just how, you know, the run for the Lynx sort of has this weird kind of up and down depending on what was going on in the office throughout right. the novel and stuff like that. It just, it is such a different world, because I mean, it feels like today if the, you know, the Lynx was publishers created, you know, even as a regular publisher, that, you know, you do everything you possibly do to keep the creative team there and stuff and keep a consistency, but that just didn't seem to be, you know, something in the 70s at times, even where reading Empire of Monsters, of how there was this moment of reprints and stuff for a number of the magazines because of financial issues the Warren was dealing with. And but they still had to, you know, feed the monster, the newsstand and everything.
Yeah, the mechanism just wasn't in place mm-hmm. to defer to creators. It was much more, it reminds me a lot of being at a newspaper. Like the issue's gonna, the newspaper's gonna come out no matter what. So you have to feed the beast, and it's gotta come out at, by X time, and you have to give it so many words. And if someone falls, somebody else has to step in and pick it up because it still has to be out there. And I think one of the things I wanted to emphasize with Secret Identity is that the creator was minimized. You were doing work for hire. 99% of the stuff being produced at that time was work for hire. And even the talent working didn't fully realize, oh, this is my idea. And there's potential here in terms of media or, you know, television or movies or action figures or all these things. It was a job. It was like making the donuts. I'm going in and I'm doing this thing. And then I'm going to go do another thing. And it was a very workmanlike blue collar approach, which I'm not saying is lost today. I think there's a lot of creators that approach it that way, but there's also so many more buffet options. You know, if you have an idea, you're not limited to bringing it to a work for hire situation. You can do it as creator owned. You can do it as a webtoon or digital comic. You can do it as, you know, self-published. You know, the options are much greater. It doesn't mean it's necessarily 1,000 times better, but you definitely have more avenues to get your vision out and control the vision. And so that was a big reason why I wanted it to be set in 1975, to really give people a sense of a totally different comic book industry. And so I think the heart of any good mystery, especially like an amateur mystery where the detective isn't a PI or a cop, you know, you have to really yank them into the mystery and make them investigate the mystery. So for me, the key thing was like, what if I take the character away? You know, what if she pours mm-hmm. herself into this character and creates this thing that is literally a piece of her soul and does it to pursue her dream, but then it's yanked away and she really has no choice unless she wants to just say goodbye to this literal like piece of her being.
That you feel like Carmen is maybe a new wave. I mean, her, or when you were looking at it, as somebody who, like you today, who has, you know, can, you know, own something and won't, you know, people will actually acknowledge that. Where back in the 70s, where, you know, you're writing Secret Identity, where it takes place, is that it was, you know, this sort of, the creator could be replaced, that there wasn't an ownership aspect. I mean, you still have Neil Adams talking about ownership and unionizing, and you have Jack Kirby's issues with Marvel, you know, definitely had, I think, right. bubbled over by then, because, and stuff like that. Do you feel, when you were writing Secret Identity, that your take in the world that you live right now and how you're looking at creator-owned and, you know, my blood, sweat, and tears went into this, and I need, you know, people need to acknowledge this, and my contracts all acknowledge that, et cetera. Mm-hmm. But then Carmen is the beginning of that, in a way, that the creators that she was dealing with, especially the older men, would just looked at it, well, you're replaceable. and your character doesn't matter because we're the only ones that made it available for the masses.
Yeah, I think it was this, I don't want to speak for anyone, but my understanding is that it was very much, you know, we're giving you this mechanism to do this work. And of course, we're going to own the work and we're going to own the pages and we're going to own it. And, you know, you're getting the privilege of writing whatever superhero you want and or whatever opportunity you've been given. And then there was no other option. There was no, you know, the conversations were starting, obviously, like the things you mentioned, like Neil Adams was pushing for more creator rights and trying to unionize, and Jack Kirby was in this prolonged battle over his original artwork. But it didn't really kind of coalesce until the next decade. And it predates Image. A lot of people point to Image as the turning point, and I think it is. But I think you start to see the first ripples like in the early to mid 80s with smaller indie companies, you know, giving creators ownership and some wiggle room to create their own stories and own them. I think that's the key component, is the ownership that you then have an option, you know, and of course the indie comics were doing that anyway, you know, and that was predated even that, but I'm just talking about mainstream, like superhero comics and, you know, genre comics you know, finally they had a runway to do that. So I think, I would say Carmen is part of those early conversations. If she were real, if she did exist, I think her experience, and I had the pleasure of talking to a lot of comic book creators and people that worked in comics, women that worked in comics at the time, first of all, to get a gut check, like, hey, is this right? Is this accurate? Is this believable? And also to get a sense of what their experiences were like. And I think it rings true. You know, the feedback I've gotten was that it rang true, which was really a huge compliment. Like, the best compliment was hearing from creators that I hadn't given the book to before, going back and saying, hey, this felt genuine, and it looks like you really did your research.
Yeah, I was did an old interview with Louise Simonson, and mm-hmm. we ended up talking a lot about her days at Warren. And the quote and the title of that episode was, like, you know, what Warren had said to her was, like, girls can't edit comics. So yeah. I have that echoing in my head as I'm reading Secret Identity of, you know, and stuff like that, and just how, you know, how you, the men in the office ended up treating her and looking at her, you know, from the get-go, even as just a secretary, you know, and that was about it for her. And it seems like, yeah, that rings about true, you know. But then also in Warren Publishing, it seems like, if, you know, like Louise, people started taking her seriously, because look at what she ended up running, you know, running at Warren and then moving on to Marvel, but basically having, you know, there's a moment at Warren that was extremely creative.
Yeah. And she was super helpful. I mean, I've known Louise a long time and Walt a long time through my various jobs at DC and at Archie. And, you know, she was very gracious with her time and, you know, was not a fact check. I walked her through kind of the initial plot idea and basically said, is this something that could happen? And she, you know, she gave me a lot of context, like the volleyball game. There's a scene where Carmen is playing in the volleyball game, mm-hmm. and that's something that was pulled from something Louise told me, and just, you know, just getting the color and context, you know, with mysteries, like there's some plausible deniability, like some stuff is just not going to happen. Like it's just not realistic, but you want to lull the reader into a sense of, could this happen? You know, and that was the goal with Secret Identity, is get all the facts right, paint a realistic picture, and then weave in the murder mystery, a slow burn murder mystery. So hopefully that succeeded.
And getting back to one thing about when people think about Image being like, that's where things really change for creators. I mean, there was First Comics and Pacific Comics,
right,
and a couple others that really, like, lit my mind on fire with the stuff they were releasing. And it was like, oh, and they're I was young enough, too young to really, like, understand, like, the legal, but looking back at, like, all the creators had a bit of this. They had some ownership to these books. I mean, this was going, you know, literally, you know, with what Carmen's doing and the fight that she has for her character, I mean, we're talking maybe 6 years later, you know, right into the 80s or earlier, people are really thinking about, what if we do offer creators, you know, ownership? What if they do have ownership to their stuff, and, you know, see what happens? And I think, you know, what First did was this whole, I mean, amazing books. There were, like, the skill and the stories and the passion that were behind a lot of the First, you know, comics that I, you know, that I read was pretty intense. So
Yeah, I mean, for me, yeah, I think you're totally right. And I learned a lot about those, like, looking backwards. I mean, I think I'm a little bit younger than you. I think when I was starting to read, my first awareness of, like, independent creator-owned comics was obviously Vertigo, which is, mm-hmm. isn't necessarily creator-owned, but it is, you know, creator-driven. But then Image, the Image Revolution, but also Dark Horse was a big yep. element there, even before Image came around. Like, I remember picking up Nexus and understanding in my own simplistic kid way that this superhero was beholden to his creators. He wasn't, you know, like, Dark Horse couldn't take Nexus away and give it to, like, Roy Thomas. You know, like, it was Steve Rude and Mike Barron, and they were the ones creating it. And that was enlightening, and it was interesting to see that develop with the Image stuff, because, you know, Image has very much become the place to do your creator-owned comics, because the deal is so creator-friendly. And that's, you know, that's, that feels like a lifetime away from where Carmen is. But I think, you know, in the book I'm working on now, all that comes into play in some way.
I was going to say, my next question, would you think Carmen would, you know, look at Image and go, maybe I should go, you know, try it again? I know how the, you know, I was wondering, you know.
I think the next book is not, you know, Carmen is ever present in the book, but she's not a central character. It's a new protagonist who, I'll give you the big pitch. You know, she left comics in the modern day, and she's working in storyboarding for film, but then she gets pulled in because this company is being rebooted. Triumph Comics is now Triumph Entertainment, and they're going to, you know, unleash their library, multimedia, you know, campaigns, comics, video games, you know, all that. And we've all heard that before. But there's this social media movement to have Annie, who's the character, come in and take over the character. So she does it because she has a passion for the character, and she grew up reading the character. But then obviously as she gets more involved in the IP and working with this company, she realizes, A, they don't get this character or what makes the character interesting, and B, there's some weird stuff with who actually owns this character and who actually created it, and what links people will go to retain ownership of something they see as, like, very viable and profitable. It's the continuation of that conversation from Secret Identity, but it's very much, I think, the other side of the coin. Like, you know, it's about creation, but it's also like, what hoops do you have to jump through, and what are you willing to jump through to create, you know?
Mm-hmm. So, more about, like, your background in influencing where you are today. Well, let's just, that joke, I mean, because you started out in newspapers, right?
Yeah.
But first, the whole thing, like, Archie has had a great run doing multimedia. Are you in this new book, and I know it's not out yet, and are you poking fun at this whole thing of, like, if we only could sell a couple movies, you know, we're saved as a publishing company. We can continue publishing. The whole idea of getting into comics to make TV or movies.
Well, I guess it's fun with that at least? It's like, interesting, yeah. I mean, I've seen it from all angles, yeah. I think, to varying degrees. But I think there's ways to go about it correctly, and I think Archie did do it well in that the content led the conversation. You know, they created stories like Afterlife with Archie and Life with Archie and the more modernized and diverse Riverdale content. And so that teed up Riverdale, the show, and that teed up Chilling Adventures of Sabrina. The content led the conversation, whereas I think a lot of times you see people kind of go into it backwards. You know, they set up the entertainment company, and then they start collecting IP to then make into media. Like, they start optioning media before the content resonates as a comic. So then you're kind of retroactively creating the comic to suit the media component. Whereas, and not to get too, like, academic about it, I think, you know, content is your doorway into anything. So if the content works as a comic, there is a way to make it work as a movie, as a show, but you don't make the comic to react to the 13th step. You know, like, you start with a comic if you want it to be a comic. You know, I mean, I think sometimes the shorthand is, well, if we make it a graphic novel first, it'll be an easier sell in Hollywood. And I don't think that's necessarily true. I think you need to do it to make it a comic. Make it a good comic, and then later on it might become a good show, but you can't, there's no guarantees. And Hollywood is it's so chaotic and so unpredictable. Like, you have to kind of see it as a really long game and you have to have that passion for the comic.
Mm-hmm. I mean, yeah, I mean, I remember reading a bunch of stuff, like, in the late 90s, and, like, it would just pop into my memory. I'm like, did that ever become a movie? No. Or the whole Chippendales on Hulu now. I remember when that a roommate of mine was at a production company at Disney, and they were all raving about this script that they just bought, or the idea of Chippendales, and here we are. It never became a movie. And it's like 20 some odd years later, basically now it's a miniseries with a completely different group of people involved. And it was just floating around there. It just, there is no guarantees. And no, it could take forever.
Yeah.
You know,
it usually does take forever. And there are no, like you said, no guarantees. I think always, you know, you should be kind of engaged with the medium you're starting in. So if you start as a comic, then you want to try and make it the best comic you can, and everything else is gravy. And obviously the financials are very different. You're going to be more compensated in the media space than you are in comics. And that's, you know, that's out of your control most of the time. But I think what doesn't work for me is the backdoor approach. And I think that's part of what I explore in the new book, is that it's not a spoiler to say this company, Triumph Entertainment, which is a zombified version of the original, wants to do it the easy way. They want to start with the show and use this known IP to create the show, and oh, let's have a comic too, just to do that. And that's what I kind of explore, which was fun. It was fun to write.
Now, I guess with Archie, did because of the content and the strength of the content that was you guys were publishing, did Hollywood come knocking, or did you have to convince Hollywood?
You know, I wasn't in those conversations. Oh, okay. I was mostly John Goldwater, our CEO. Yeah. But my understanding was that Hollywood did come knocking because they saw the level of attention, media attention, the new content was getting, and also the quality of the content. I think it was mainly, you know, John Goldwater and Roberto Aguirre-Sacasa, who ended up becoming the showrunner of Riverdale, and Katie Keene and Sabrina. You know, Roberto had a passion for these characters, and paired with John, they really had a vision for how to modernize the IP without sacrificing what made it engaging. And I think when you read an Archie comic, whether it's a new Archie comic or a classic comic or a horror comic, the characters are who they are. They're flexible, they're entertaining, but they are true to themselves. And I think that resonated with the whole fan base.
Yeah, and I have to say, like, I did a lot of reading of Archie back there, you know, the first time we talked, and I was just impressed by just everything, because I never read an Archie comic when I was first into comics. I just, you know, I was like, oh, that's for my sister or somebody younger. But just the quality and stuff. And my experience with Hollywood is that it's always easier when they come knocking, when they want to ask you out, instead of trying to convince them that they need to have this. There's a different level, different kind of passion, which can probably carry you a little bit, you know, longer throughout the process.
Yeah, I mean, it's always nice to be asked as opposed to knocking down doors, 100%.
So you started out in newspapers. You're from Miami. And reading all your stuff recently and catching up on things, there's a number of threads in your characters and in your stories that, you know, connect or direct lines to your experiences and stuff. And then you come into comics and stop me if I'm wrong, but you started as in marketing, right? In DC, at DC. No, you started at Wizard, if I remember correctly.
I started at Wizard. I was an associate editor at Wizard for a couple of years, and then I moved back to Miami to work in newspapers again. And then I did some freelance publicity for Archie from Miami, but the next full-time gig was moving to New York and working at DC in the publicity department. Yeah.
And then moved back to Archie after your time at DC, and then how long were you at Archie?
I would say cumulatively those two stints were about 10 years, almost 10 years total. Mm-hmm. So off and on about 10 years, with a 2-year gap, where I went back to DC, and then they moved to Burbank, and I wasn't ready to make that move. So I hopped back to Riverdale.
Okay. And then, at one point while you're at Archie, you started up Dark Circle, where you edited that line of basically Archie's superhero line and sort of crime line in a way.
Yeah.
Now,
yeah, I think the idea there, the name Dark Circle came from John Goldwater, the CEO, and his idea and our idea was really, let's take these characters and not approach it as a traditional, like, superhero, quote unquote, universe with a lot of continuity and a lot, you know, we just couldn't compete with DC and Marvel in the straight superhero game. Like, just action crossovers and that. So we approached it more as a network, like HBO. Like each book will have a different genre or occupy a different space. Black Hood will be your crime noir book. The Shield is your conspiracy super spy book. You know, Hangman is your horror book, and so on. And you know, I think, you know, it was my first experience as an editor, and I was thankful to have people like Paul Kaminsky there and Mike Pellerito there to kind of help me go through, and Jamie Rotante, who's still at Archie now, and she was essential to the whole process. So it was definitely a learning experience, and lessons I've taken on to other things. Even though I'm not an editor per se now, a lot of those project management things I learned were really helpful to me and are still helpful to me.
Well, I have to say it's refreshing to hear that they didn't want to just, you know, become another Marvel or DC. The approach to using, you know, guys in costumes and just having that different sort of approach makes it a lot easier to accessible at first. But
I think part of it was also you don't want to compel someone to feel like, oh, you need to buy 10 books to understand one. I think you... And these characters had been languishing in limbo for a little bit. And, you know, I think fans like Red Circle, Super Archie superhero fans are a little mixed on Dark Circle. Some of them really enjoyed it, and some of them felt it was like too stark a departure. But I felt like you really needed that to kind of jumpstart the characters. And we tried something different.
It sounds like this was the first time you really got into project managing, because what I'm trying to get to is like, the production you have as a writer nowadays seems, you know, is pretty, you know, you have a lot of spinning plates. So was this the first time that you really had to dig in and learn, you know, sort of figure out your way of managing, you know, a number of spinning plates?
Yeah, it was definitely a crash course in that. I mean, managing a publicity campaign and a marketing campaign is very different from managing an editorial. You know, I've done editorial. Obviously, I worked at Wizard. So there's, you know, you have publishing schedules, you have content calendars that you have to fill. So it was similar to that. I didn't feel like totally blind going into it, but I'd never project managed a comic. I'd seen people do it. And, you know, at DC, I spent a lot of time sitting in editors' offices watching how they worked. But mostly that was a means to an end. Like, hey, you know, Steve Wacker, you're editing 52. Can you tell me what's coming up here and here and here so then I can promote it? Whereas here, like running, being part of that, I had to then determine like what beats were hitting when, you know, write solicit copy, coordinate covers and things like that. So it was, you know, hindsight's 20/20. I'm sure I would have done things differently now, but it was a great crash course and I had great teachers on the way. So,
well, I mean, what was the first thing they sort of had to break the ice on this with seeing you have people that were, you could lean on? Did you just take sort of their model, or was it, one from column A, one from column B? Because in all the years of talking with editors, there's no real, I mean, there's a lot of, you know, making deadlines is something, but every editor has a unique approach and, you know, that brings in different talent and stuff like that, but it's really a personality based thing and how you work. So how did you start creating your workflow, I guess, for lack of a better term?
The benefit for me coming in was that I was already a writer. You know, I'd written a few novels at that point. I had written some comics. And I think I always tried to flip it. I tried to flip the perspective. Like, how would I want the editor to engage with me in this situation? So you treat, you know, artists and creators don't want to be brought onto a book to then be kind of hyper managed, or you're kind of told what to write or told what to draw. So I think what we tried to do was create situations, though I can't say if we were 1,000% successful. There's definitely, you know, with IP and work for hire, you're always going to want characters to do things based on, you know, you have your corporate requirements. Like you can only, you know, there's certain things you have to do. But I did try really hard to bring in talent and let them do what they wanted to do, you know, within the constraints of work for hire. Was I as super meticulous about scheduling and deadlines? You know, I think, you know, like I said, hindsight's 20/20. I could have probably been a stricter editor in terms of stuff like that. But the books came out, they came out relatively on time. And I think, you know, for me, quality always trumps being right on time. You know, if you have to sacrifice a week here and there to make sure that the book comes in and it's at the level you want it, then I'll do that. But it was a learning curve. You know, I'm not going to lie. Like, it was my first time being an editor. It was kind of a crash course, but it was really thrilling. And I think the content holds up for the most part.
What novels had you written prior to that? Because taking on a novel is a great deal of discipline to see it through. Was it the?
I want to say that I was at least three novels in. So I'd written the first, the Pete Fernandez series. So I think I was working on Dangerous Ends, and then there were two more still in the pipeline. And then, so that's kind of where I was.
Yeah, maintaining that discipline and then coming in your day job as running something, did you look at deadlines differently? Did you pad your deadlines at all? Is that something that maybe you could look at a little different? I mean, you looking back, you're like, oh, is that the issue where I needed to maybe start sooner or have?
There's no universal solution. Yeah. I think it's an interesting question. I think it really depends on the talent. Like some talent, and I speak of this as a creator myself, like sometimes some creators are like really precise with their deadlines and they'll deliver it on the day of. Some deliver it early, some need a little nudging or reminding, and so you kind of cater your communications to whoever you're dealing with.
Mm-hmm. Now how has that affected you as somebody who has a lot of spinning plates with your deadlines? Are you one of those who deliver right on time, or
I like to be communicative. I can't say that I'm always 100% on time. Like, but if I'm running late, I tend to reach out to my editor and say, "Hey, this is kind of running hot." Like, especially with novels, are just like such gargantuan efforts. Like, you know, you can't just like forget to tell your editor if the book is coming. You know, like they have an expectation. They're putting it on a schedule of span. Like, you know, publishing of novels like runs so far ahead. Mm-hmm. I guess the biggest lesson I've learned is that as a freelancer now writing full time, it's like I'm the company, I'm running the publishing company of me. And so my projects, you know, I have to kind of manage them and dictate, you know, what time will be spent on each thing. You know, last night I worked on a pitch. This morning I worked on Alter Ego, which is the next novel. And, you know, I carve out some time to do like the day-to-day business email stuff. But there's always a project that's in first position. Like, this is a thing that needs to get cranked on. And then there are other smaller things that I can do interstitially between, I guess, the big strokes.
Is there a period where you find yourself more creative, or is it just you're not really getting into that kind of looking at your day to day that this is the only time, you know, this is the time I write? Or are you a little more fluid on your, when you're inspired?
Yeah, I mean, I'm pretty workmanlike, and I also try to treat it as work. You know, I think I want the inspiration to come. I want to feel jazzed and excited, but I also can't skip the writing part just waiting for lightning to strike. I'm a big outliner, especially with novels. I like to plan out what the book is going to be and then allow myself the room to layer things in, layer in my voice, make it really feel exciting as I'm writing it. But I can't not write. You know, I can't, like, I think people experience writer's block in different ways. Like for me, it's like I really don't have the option to not do that. So I have things I do to kind of get me going. And a lot of it is you know, listening to music or looking, you know, creating vision boards for projects, or even just engaging with work that gets me excited and then will in turn get me excited to do the work, you know? So I have room for creative engagement and excitement, but I also have kind of created a situation where I want to keep writing, you know, like I can't just skip a day because I'm not feeling inspired is my point.
Yeah. And is it because now when you were working for Archie or any of the companies you've worked for, that there was definitely, you know, a safety net that company was providing the paycheck. And as you say, you're basically your own publisher, you know, is it because now you're sort of playing without a net? In a way,
I mean, I guess you're creating your own net, you know, the net is yours, as opposed to, you know, I can have a bad day at work, but I'll still get my paycheck no matter what. And I think that still applies, like with publishing contracts, you're still going to get paid, but it's delivery based, you know, you're getting paid to do the work and it's very quantifiable. Whereas, you know, you can't really like zone out for a couple weeks because you're having a bad week. Not that I did that when I was working. But yeah, it's all on your shoulders as opposed to the infrastructure of a company, which is a little daunting at first. I'm not going to lie.
Mm-hmm. Now, as you moved through, you went through Dark Circle and you got that up and running, and then you ended up, you know, spending a great deal of time at Archie and moving up. And, you know, I basically, as you were saying, you were co-president finally before.
Yeah.
And how did that affect your creative, you know, the your side gig? Basically, were you, because of this experience you had in project management, you know, and, you know, going through Dark Circle and the learning, you know, learning stuff with that, and then eventually becoming co-president and having those responsibilities, were you able to basically carve out time during your day to maintain the creative side? Because I think that's around the time, I don't know, you popped on my radar where there was the Pete Fernandez series and some other books that you were, you know, books and also comics you were involved in. You were also writing for Archie. Did you sort of, did something click for you of how to have this, you know, being this productive during your day job and also productive during your creative job?
Yeah, I guess the thing I always tell people is that, you know, I turned my hobbies into careers. So these things that I would have probably done for fun anyway became jobs. And so for me, it was fun to, after a day's work, go home and work on my novel or go home and work on a comic script. I think the challenge when I became co-president, you know, was, you know, if I'm overseeing these books, it felt a little weird to then give myself one of those books, you know, like to write. So what happened then was that I ended up really only writing like the music stuff. Like, so I did Archie Meets the B-52s and everything else really kind of predated my time editing any of the Archie content. So there was just like a little bit of a church and state there, which I thought was fair. Like, you know, I think if I'm deciding who gets what assignment for certain things with input from obviously John and Mike and everyone else that was there, I didn't want it to feel like, oh, he's just giving himself like the plum gigs. And stuff was really happening in terms of my other writing. So I was focusing on stuff like The Black Ghost and was launching and my novels. So it felt like a very robust schedule, a very full schedule, but it was also fun. So I can't really treat it like I'm just working nonstop.
Oh, and an aside, basically, that's where it is that when I was reading Secret Identity and everybody, you know, Carmen walks into CBGB's, I'm like, where have I, I'm like, wait, okay, now it's yeah, all making clear, because like you wrote the one with B-52s. Did you write the one with Archie Meets the Ramones?
Yep, I co-wrote that with Matt Rosenberg, both of those.
Okay, so I guess that period is also something we might see more of, or basically of that, you know, in the 70s, I don't know, maybe down the road, there might be, are you fascinated with the punk
scene? Yeah, I love that era. Your... I love music. I have, I have a really strong idea for like a band story that weaves through that era. So yeah, that's something I definitely think about a lot.
You went back to marketing, right? With Oni.
Yes, I moved on to Oni. I was their SVP of sales and marketing. And so I oversaw, and you know, I'm like a jack of all trades. So while that was my title per se, I did do a lot of other things like engaging with talent and, you know, biz development and things like that. Just, I mean, I guess I like to be busy, and it was, it was a good situation. And then I just moved on to writing full time. It just felt like the right moment to do that.
Was there something at Oni or, you know, that percolating after Archie or beginning because of looking at it that you're like, you felt that this was the right time to make the leap? I think we briefly talked about that at New York Comic Con of like, you were, you know, like when to become a full-time writer. What was it, you know, from your experiences leading up to pulling the trigger on that? Was it?
Yeah, I think it was always in the back of my mind. Like, that's always a long-term goal. You want to you write, and so therefore you want to make that your full-time gig. But I also liked working in-house. You know, I liked being part of publishing decisions and things like that. And Oni felt like a good, I don't want to say transitional, because I didn't know how long I would be there, but it felt like a good pivot towards writing full-time. You know, I got to, you know, deal in more creator-owned work, and it was a different kind of philosophy, which was interesting to be part of. And then when they had their restructuring, it just felt like, okay, well, this is now, you know, sometimes the stars align and point you in a direction. And so it felt like the right time to try and write full time, and it's worked out. So that's been a blessing.
So how does that lead into the podcast that you ended up doing for NPR? Because that's sort of like, I mean, once again, it's part writing, but there's a lot more with.
Yeah, that was interesting. Podcast. Yeah, and that showed up, that kind of came in at an interesting time because I was at Archie when I did the initial interviews, and then I moved on to Oni, and then the project, you know, took a while, but it was a combination of like, yeah, having a day job, but then also putting the book together and then being creatively involved. Like NPR's Planet Money podcast, which is their business podcast, was doing a series on IP and comic book IP and trying to purchase IP from Marvel or DC. And I was interviewed for the first episode where I basically said, look, they're just not going to sell you IP. Like, you know, it's a good story away from like a $1 billion empire. And so then I walked them through like public domain and how they might want to do a public domain superhero. And they discovered this obscure character, Microface. And so in the process, they were like, well, we want to make a comic book. And that's where I got looped in creatively. And I helped them bring in people like Jamal Igle to do the interiors. Jerry Ordway redesigned a character. And then I wrote the story, which was very much like a legacy superhero take. And that was a lot of fun. I mean, you have the platform of Planet Money and NPR. And the comic itself was very, you know, in-world. It was, you know, it was a business adventure superhero strip, which was really neat to do. But it also evoked a lot of books that I loved as well. So it was meta in, like, the best way.
It goes back, you know, and here we are. It's always meta. I'm just like, okay, I know you have to be out in about a couple of minutes. I'm just trying to, like, you do more than writing, really. You know, it's just, that's really what it seems like, that you, even though writing seems to be the thing to driving, it's that basically you are doing, everything comes together still. Is that...
Well, yeah. I mean, I tell other writers that I feel really grateful to have had that experience in marketing and publicity because I can have that knowledge base of like how to promote a book and how to kind of guide either the in-house publicist I'm working with or the marketing people, not guide, but at least give feedback and knowledgeable feedback. And then also just the project management part of it from a comic book perspective, like especially with creator-owned books, it's helpful to the editor, you know, the actual editor and the company knowing that, okay, he can put together a team and kind of execute if needed. And that I find that to be useful. So, yeah, I mean, I'm just treating it now like my writing is my company and I work for myself, and that's been gratifying.
So, Alex, I know I got to let you go. So thank you very
much. Thanks so much for having me.
And I'm looking forward to the sequel to Secret Identity and a whole bunch of other things that you're about to release upon us. And it was great catching up.
Thanks so much. Okay. Yeah, always a pleasure. And yeah, I hope you enjoy it. I hope I can finish it sooner rather than later.
Okay. Great.
All right. Take care.
Thank you. See you.
Bye. Bye.